diners, travelers, cookbook readers, and just about everybody who's involved with the world of food, wine, travel, and lifestyle. You're joining Ann and Peter Haig in On the Menu. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning. We have a whole new start this morning.
I have a little
news for your listeners. This is the second time we started recording this program. For some reason, for the first 10 seconds of the first try, Ann was completely
speechless.
Speechless, yes. Awestruck, something like that.
Tongue-tied.
I guess you're always awestruck when you have a wonderful guest on the program.
This is it. I'm impressed.
Like we have today. Plus, she's also having trouble. She's having difficulty breathing because
I'm holding this cookbook.
called After the Hunt, which is a full 5 pounds. It's not a coffee table book.
Is it only five pounds?
It's a coffee table size book. Contributed by the wonderful Chef John Falls. John, good morning. Welcome back to On the Menu.
Peter, and it's so nice to be with y'all, and thank you so very much. And by the way, Peter, that's 11 pounds.
This was not 5 pounds.
I thought I read somewhere that he weighed 5 pounds. I think that's what Food Arts said, and Food Arts, because doesn't know how to weigh things, I suppose.
and Chef John, you are one handsome devil, especially with an alligator.
That's not him.
It's not.
No, that's not.
Who is that?
It's not you on the cover, John, right?
that's me on the cover. And, you know, people always ask.
It is you.
Is
that photoshopped on the cover? Absolutely not. That's a 9-foot, 150-pound Louisiana swamp alligator. Across my shoulder there, and of course normally you see me in that chef jacket with that white toque, and for me to be in hunting gear with that nice hunter's hat on my head, Peter, I could see where you'd be a little confused.
No, he was confused, but inside there is the original photograph.
That's what it is. So you're modeling an original photo.
Well, you know, a couple of years ago we decided, when I did the Encyclopedia of Cajun and Creole Cuisine, I decided to take a historic print in Louisiana and then duplicated for the cover using a topic, obviously, that was the format of the book. So in the encyclopedia, I used the old Cajun oyster fisherman on the cover, and I put the original photograph inside so everybody could see the 1930s picture. And then on the cover of After the Hunt, I'm using a 1940 alligator hunter coming out of the swamps of Louisiana with an alligator on his shoulder, and it was the perfect picture to redo for the cover, which I shot in the swamps of Louisiana this past September. So,
is that a live alligator?
I hope not.
but can you imagine the size of that thing to have a 150-pound, 9-foot alligator on your shoulder? It's an easy thing to do and still smile, you know what I mean?
But you admit at the beginning of the book, John, that You're not even a hunter.
Absolutely. I think you have to be very honest. I was born and reared in the swamps of Louisiana, and of course, as I say in the foreword of the book, that I come from a great line of hunters, and my father was a fabulous hunter. In fact, he made his living as a trapper in the swamps of Louisiana. He trapped furs, mink and otter, beaver, muskrat, and of course, from my earliest recollections of the kitchen, most of the meat that came from wild game from that swamp floor pantry made its way into the cast iron pots, and of course became our nourishment. You know, so whether it was raccoons or whether it was alligator meat or whether it was a rabbit, venison, it didn't matter. We were very, very used to it. But
I better mention that the name of this book is called After the Hunt. Louisiana's authoritative collection of wild game and game fish cookery, and everything is in it. Absolutely everything.
I think so. I want to make sure that even exotic game, as I just mentioned, the beaver and these things that were such delicacies in the 1800s and very early 1900s, that we didn't forget that at one time we did cook and enjoy these animals. So today, even though we're eating a lot more venison or rabbit or quail and ducks, I mean, we did at
and
one
not
time.
Not so much squirrel. squirrel.
And squirrel. I mean, that's a big delicacy in Louisiana, squirrel. Sure.
Well, now I understand rabbit is, too. And there's a place called Iowa, Louisiana, where they're going to have a rabbit festival. I was so fascinated, I actually put it up on the news part of the website.
That's right. They do the rabbit festival there every year, and they have cook-offs using rabbit with chefs and novices all cooking rabbit in different Louisiana dishes. Look, if it's an animal walking or flying in Louisiana, there's a festival to pay homage to it in a pod, you know?
And if it's swimming too, I guess.
John, tell us how, I mean, I'm looking at this table of contents. You go back to the history of hunting, back to prehistory, just about.
Well, you know, I think it's so important. Ever since the Encyclopedia of Cajun and Creole Cuisine was written a couple of years ago, I found that so many people around the world who picked up the book took time to send me a note or a letter saying, "Thank God for giving us the history of this cuisine, this topic. We didn't know what Cajun was. We didn't understand that Creole."
Oh, I love
were.
That book.
I was taken aback by the fact that so many books are great at recipes and beautiful photography, and they show you how to make a wonderful stock. But when it comes to explaining why do we eat these things, what's the origin of these dishes? Where did these things originate? That the books didn't do a really good job on that. So after the response we got on Encyclopedia, and we started on After the Hunt, Barnes & Noble had asked that I do a book on hunting and wild game, because sportsmen had been asking for a book on hunting for a while, and there really wasn't one authoritative text. So that's what enticed me to do it. And, of course, the first thing I had to do was go back and study the history of hunting. Why does man hunt? What's the need to hunt? How did hunting play its part in a... And, of course, you see what happened in the front there, from the cave drawings of France all the way to the discovery of America. We talk about game as it moved through the generations.
Right. Now, I mean, I don't know, though, in terms of, was this once in vogue, pan-fried squirrel brains?
Absolutely. It still is in many places.
Really?
Because, you know, brains as a breakfast item has been in many of the Parisian restaurants, many of the restaurants of Vienna, you're going to find brains on toast. And of course, in the wild game areas of Louisiana, animal brains, whether it was squirrel, rabbit, venison, whatever, certainly was enjoyed equally, you know. So, absolutely. I thought it was important to put that in the book.
Well, now, you have a history of the progression, though. Of cooking wild game, that's really interesting. This little page that I have tabbed right here is interesting because you include a fish section and a shellfish section in the book, because I guess we do hunt those two, although in a slightly different way. But here's this fascinating little note that says it's called medieval logic. And well, perhaps you can just tell us about medieval logic. It's to do with what you can eat on a Friday.
Well, I don't have the book sitting in front of me here, but I mean, what we tried to do, and that is an example of it right there, is throughout the ages, people wrote about things that were important to them in hunting or in fishing or in how they serve things. And I found them so fascinating that we did these little sidebars throughout the book to bring those to the forefront that would give the reader some interesting little tidbits into the history of the way people ate things or cooked things.
I think it's fascinating. I mean, I think that one of the classifications was anything that had a tail on it was considered a fish for consuming on Friday.
Like beaver was considered a fish.
Well, also that medieval logic made its way into modern day Catholicism in the Catholic Church in Louisiana, when they designated waterfowl, ducks that spent the majority of their time on water, should be considered a fish.
And so you can eat them on Fridays.
No, absolutely. And ducks that are a particular duck in Louisiana called the pouldu, which in French means water chicken. It's a coot in sportsman's terms. It's a black a coot. And this bird was one of those designated by the Catholic Church in early Louisiana to be classified a fish to be able to eat on Friday rather than lose the ability to eat meat when the church had outlawed the eating of meat on Friday. So this medieval logic certainly followed its way into the 20th century, you know.
Well, you know, tell us about the illustrations here and the photographs and the reproductions of paintings, historical paintings. I mean, you have Rubens in here mixed with WPA photographs. It's just amazing.
Well, again, Anne, I think the main thing is that we were so just, we were overwhelmed by how hunting had been chronicled throughout the generations. I mean, as I say, from caveman drawing the running stags with the antlers on the cave drawings of Altamira, France, so many thousands and millions of years ago, that if they took the time to do a picture of what they were eating on the cave drawings, and here you find the great masters of Europe going back to the 1500s and before, documenting in great art and massive paintings for the kings and chateaus of Europe their hunting scenes, because the kings kept these massive menageries of game parks, I guess we should call them, of game living on the compound. Symphonies were created by some of the greatest, even Mozart created hunting symphonies where guns were actually shot in the place of the drums and these hunting symphonies that actually followed the king in the hunts through Europe. And then, of course, we find that once the camera comes in, that people started to record their catches, and they were proud of the deer they killed or whatever, and they recorded that. So we wanted to make sure, I think the earliest prints that we were able to find and purchase to use inside of the book was from the 13 or 1400s, showing how game was actually captured that had been painted on canvas, and showing the nets that captured rabbits. And this was our first view into how people hunted during the Dark Ages, actually. And to be able to showcase all of that in the book and show early camouflage and show the development of camouflage on the Roman chariots, that they actually put branches on the chariots so that all the pharaohs of Egypt could hide behind chariots covered with trees and branches. This was so fascinating to us that if anybody loved hunting, even those who didn't love hunting but loved history,
yes,
would be able to dive straight into this book. If they never cooked a piece of game in their life, it would be fascinating how hunting and the sport of hunting developed till today, you know.
But, you know, don't overlook the recipes. I mean,
I wanted to come to the recipes in just a minute, but the couple of other things in early part of the book that you can't pass by, because this is not just a book about game as food. It's also a book about how to go about the process of hunting, with a section on guns, with a section on the right kinds of dogs to use for particular purposes.
Dogs,
so,
dogs.
I mean, your team had fun here. Now, you are willing to admit, John, that you didn't write every word in this book.
Oh, of course not. I mean, you can't. There's no way, Peter, any one person could put together a work of that size I'm a proud daddy saying that quality, because it took, as you can see, seven spectacular people. Michelle Yark, who I consider to be one of the finest researchers probably in America, she's on my staff and has been for 11 years, and Michelle Yark has become synonymous, I think, in Louisiana and in writing with the greatest pantry of historical record, I should say. She's been living in archives ever since we wrote the encyclopedia, and has become a great fan of early American cuisine, and then, of course, she got into the hunting quite a bit, and now I would say she's an authority on hunting as well. And then I have Karen Stassi, who's a great writer, researcher. I have Dan Ling Gao, who's from China, but yet she came in and became a fabulous researcher as well. So to be able to, and one was on art, and one was on tools of the hunt, and one was on wine pairings, and I was on recipe development, and Michelle was in archives looking at the history of hunting from the beginning of time all the way through Europe, and then, of course, the founding of America and the Hudson Bay Company of Canada. So to be able to put a work like that together, I know y'all certainly appreciate the number of people who devote their lives and times. And you notice the shock is that that book was completed, if you can believe this, in 11 months.
See, that was what I was going to ask you. How long did all this take?
Well, you always did like to do things fast. You remember when we talked about cheese, you said you made it from the concept of starting to make cheese to winning an international gold medal at some cheese conference in London in less than 2 years.
But Peter, you know the secret is this, and you have to be willing to admit that everybody's good at something, and I know what I'm really great at, and I'm happy to admit it. I'm great at selecting a fabulous team of people who can buy into the vision, and then without being prodded and pushed and shoved, they get excited about it. They motivate themselves to create wonderful things, and then all I have to do is do what I do best, and that's choose the recipes, test them, put them into the book, and meet with this team once a week to make sure we're all on schedule, doing what we need to do, looking at the materials that they're collecting. And that's what you have to be able to surround yourself with the right people and people who are excited about the vision and make that a part of their own vision. And that's why you see what you have in your hands there. It's not about me. It's about us, you know.
Now, have you tested all these recipes?
Every one of those
recipes. Every single one, wow.
There's over 550 recipes in the book, and for the listeners out there who's listening to us talk about squirrel brains and beaver tail.
Oh, no, but they're straightforward things that everybody can use.
Yeah, no,
grilled fish.
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, we have a full chapters on seafood and shellfish and desserts and vegetables. And, of course, conventional game. Naturally, the great venison recipes. We have from hors d'oeuvres to soups to entrees. We have quail. We have pheasant. We have all the game birds. We have all of the ducks. So the book is varied enough so that anybody who either hunts or knows a hunter or knows where to find domesticated game at some of the game companies where you can buy domesticated game, you can certainly find something in the book you'll love to cook, you know.
Oh, yes, and it's getting rarer, but to be able to find decent game at an affordable price, actually. But you include things like turkey. Hello?
Yes.
Things that anybody can get, and duck is easy to lay hands on.
Yeah, right, and then in the back of the book, when we put our resources to where one can buy game online or through mail order, that was important too. We wanted certainly to be able to have people first of all know that you can buy game without going out and kill it yourself, but second of all also to encourage people to try some of these recipes using non-game animals. I mean, if you have a turkey from the store, or you have a duck from the store, or you have chicken, I mean, or beef, or whatever, try some of these game-flavored recipes with the game rubs and all of that on pork or whatever, and you're going to have a new experience. So,
the more I look at this book, the more I find things that I missed first. Ariane.
It would be easy to understand why you missed it.
I know.
How many pages does it take to make up 11 pounds a book?
Well, we have about 870 pages there.
Okay.
And then of course we have so much of the wonderful photography of early Louisiana hunting and early European hunting. So just the photography alone, I think, is really spectacular in the book. Look, we wrote the book, and I still sit down with it and thumb through it and say, oh my God, look how great this looks.
Oh, it is.
Well, listen, John, we without taking the opportunity to get an update from you about how things are coming with Hurricane Katrina recovery. We know that you made a huge personal contribution to helping people who are living in the difficult circumstances. But how are things now? Give us a real time update on how you feel things have progressed.
Well, Peter, I'm real happy with where things are going. We back to in the restaurants in New Orleans, we back to pre-Katrina numbers, and most all of the original Grand Dame restaurants in New Orleans, Commander's Palace, Galatoire's, Arnaud's, all Antoine's, all of these restaurants are back in business. The
and
Brennan
Dookie
family,
Chase too.
What's that?
Dookie Chase too. Is that
yeah, Leah Chase, and I was so happy to be able to work with Leah Chase to get her restaurant off of the ground. If people walked into downtown New Orleans today with Mardi Gras rolling, we're back to pre-Mardi Gras, pre-Katrina numbers in Mardi Gras. The hotels are full. But at the same time, we still have some of the sad parts of New Orleans. We still have that Ninth Ward that was so devastated that still is trying to find its way back. We still have people around the country that's certainly trying to come back home. They have Louisiana in their blood, and little by little, they're making their way back as soon as housing is available for them. But I can say this, that it's been a monumental task to put the state back together, and the people, my God, the people of America who came to our rescue, if we started to thank them today, it would take a million years to do. In fact, from Altoona, Pennsylvania, a company that I will never forget as long as I live, the Sheets company from Altoona that does, convenience stores.
Right.
I'll never forget the day I got a call from Sheets that said, Chef, somebody gave us your name, and they said you're working with Relief in New Orleans for the hurricane, that you have a food manufacturing plant. We want to start sending down an 18-wheeler a week of food from Pennsylvania, and you disperse it however you want. We don't need you to tell us anything about what you're going to do with it. All we want to do is to make sure it gets to the right people. And when that first truck rolled in from Altoona, and it was full of eggs and breakfast sausage biscuits, and I walked into some of the shelters of Louisiana with over 400 people and young children and roll out those breakfast items that Sheets had sent us. My God, I thought that I thought that heaven had opened up, because they hadn't seen eggs and biscuits and bacon in a month, and here because of somebody from Altoona who opened up their hearts and wallets. And every week I got a call from Altoona saying, John, what else do you need? So, you know, it's people like this, I mean, that we'll never, ever be able to thank. They know what they did. They know how their contribution saved so many people. In fact, saved lives here. There's no doubt about it. And I told that story when I was at Penn State this weekend at State College. I told the story to a room of over 300 people. I said, you know, you don't know how little villages and hamlets and towns across America, including Altoona right here, what they did one day to put smiles on hundreds, or if not thousands, of people's faces. You know, nobody knows this. So, anyways, coming back fine. I'm happy to say that I'm personally happy with the results. There's still a lot to be done. But my God, look how far we've come!
Oh, yeah.
Well, this is just a wonderful news from the front. John, you were a big part yourself in making sure the people got fed, aside from with the help from Sheets and lots of other people. So we got to come down there again and catch up with you and just experience it for ourselves. We were down there in February 2007. And we saw it coming back, but it wasn't there. We're so delighted to know that it's that much further along now.
And, you know, John, you're always expanding in what you do. How about a website? Can you give our listeners
a website? My website is www.j, just the initial, jfalse.com. If you go to jfalse.com, your listeners can download for free literally thousands of great recipes, including game recipes. I have a company store there as well. If people are interested in the book, I've done 8 cookbooks on Louisiana cooking, including After the Hunt that we're talking about today. They're available there. We sign and ship them anywhere. But moreover, there's a little. My email address is on there as well. If you have questions about cooking or what wines to serve with game or whatever, I'm always happy to talk to anyone about about food and Louisiana food and culture especially. So please feel free to drop me a line.
JohnJFalls.com. We're always happy to talk to you, and thank you.
This is the second most famous Louisianan after Thomas Jefferson.
Well, y'all,
without,
I tell you,
without whom none of this would be possible.
Well, let me just tell you this: you don't know how much I appreciate hearing from y'all. Y'all always such a delight, and once again to the people of Pittsburgh and Pennsylvania in general, you can't imagine what place I hold in my heart for all of y'all, because you're great people. And if I didn't live in Louisiana, I'd be moving up north to Pittsburgh or Pennsylvania somewhere.
I'm not so sure. It's raining a lot here.
Okay, John. Well, listen, go and enjoy your part of Mardi Gras, and then remember to start fasting tomorrow, and we have to go do something.
And please let me know when y'all come into Louisiana. I would love to host y'all at Lafitte's in my bed and breakfast. You have a room anytime you want to stop at the inn, okay?
You got it.
Thank you,
John.
Bye-bye, y'all.
Thanks. It's time that we take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. We diving
would be appropriate. Diving into a different subject than the last time, but a very important one.
Right, one it's just so complicated for the average person. But Paul Johnson, who is a seafood wholesaler in San Francisco, and he's also on the advisory board of the Monterey Seafood Aquarium. Is that what it's called? The watchdog for all. Sustainable and healthy?
It's the Monterey Aquarium Seafood Watch Program.
Okay. And, which I trust.
Yes, yes, yes.
And
they
have their green
cards, and they encourage consumers to buy sustainably.
Well, now, Paul has written this book called Fish Forever, which I think absolutely has been needed, because I keep seeing it referenced everywhere and quotes taken from it everywhere, and it's subtitled The Definitive Guide to Understanding, Selecting, and Preparing Healthy, Delicious, and Environmentally Sustainable Seafood. That's a mouthful, Paul.
Yes, it is.
But there's so much information packed in this book. It just astounds me. Could you mention a little bit about how you organized it?
Well, what I tried to do is I tried to just look at the most common species in the marketplace, the stuff that we might find any place in the nation, and just look at those in an alphabetical setting, so that we go all the way from anchovies to wreckfish. And under each heading, what I tried to do is I tried to split it up. First, I gave a little information about the species, and then I had a subheading, which is entitled In the Kitchen, and I tried to tell you, possibly the best sauces and style of cooking for each species.
And you have experience in kitchens, so.
Yes, I do. I cooked for about 10 or 12 years in various restaurants around the Bay Area.
And the recipes sound really interesting. Some of them are sort of ethnic classics, too.
Good, yeah. I tried to take stuff that was, I tried to make recipes which were familiar to people and yet was relatively simple, you know.
Right.
And I tried to give a lot of sauces, because I think that cooking fish is relatively simple, and I think that people really
want
sauces.
People are afraid
sauces.
Of cooking fish. You even have a section on how to tell what it's done, which is another whole issue. But the two critical issues with this book is people are confused about what is sustainable, and that keeps shifting.
Yes.
And also, is it healthy? Is it poisoning us, or what? I mean, there's so many mixed signals out there. What do you say about these issues?
Exactly. I think those are the two major issues that I try to cover in the book. And, you know, I'm a seafood wholesaler here in San Francisco, and I think that, and I'm also a retailer. We have a small retail store. And those are the questions that customers, consumers, and chefs would come to me time and time again, asking me those questions, such as, you know, what about the article in the New York Times today about mercury in
that
storage,
tuna article,
and tuna and stuff
tuna
like
sales.
That.
in Manhattan down the tubes.
Exactly, exactly.
And what is your read on that?
I know it might be a bad thing. That might mean we can afford to buy it now.
Exactly. Well, you know, I think that, you know, each individual species has its own concerns, and I think it's more than just mercury. That seems to be really high profile. That's what people
you
are
know,
concerned
the
with.
Parasites.
That. Yeah, there's parasites, there's bacteria, you know, there's, I don't want to go into a whole
I know,
laundry
you're talking to somebody
because it'll
who
scare
eats
people away.
Every piece of raw fish you get her hands on, by the way.
Right. But, yeah. But there's issues with everything, just as there are with all foods, you know. And really, you know, the intelligent consumer is educated. And that's what you have to do. That's what you should do with all foods, you know. And you should eat a well-balanced diet. You know, if you go out and eat grapefruit six times a day and drink too much water, it can be harmful, you know?
Yeah.
So I think you just have to be reasonable about your diet and look at it from a point of view that we all have to, you know, there are issues with all foods, but, you know, if we're educated, we can figure out the right thing to do.
Right. Now, and you have a definite list, though, because I have a pregnant daughter, and I have a one-year-old mm-hmm. granddaughter, and when she was pregnant, there was fish was a big issue.
Right.
And you seem to agree with that. You
well,
have
I
limitations
do.
On what pregnant women should eat by way of fish.
Absolutely, because I think, you know, in a situation like that, you don't want to have to look, you know, I don't think that most of these issues are, you know, oftentimes many of the issues are not covered for women, you know. Like oftentimes people don't realize that pregnant women or nursing women should not be eating raw shellfish. They should not be eating raw smoked salmon. And these are other issues which are not touched upon. And as far as mercury goes, I think that, there's a couple of studies which have been done, which I have in an appendix in the back of my book, which people should really read and get a better feeling for really the issue of mercury, you know, because...
Yeah, I mean, it's very low, actually, isn't it?
Yeah, it's, you know, the thing is, if you're pregnant, you don't want to take a chance, you know. You don't want to be sorry down the line. So the best thing to do if you're pregnant is not to, or thinking about getting pregnant, you should not eat any of the big top of the food chain fish, such as swordfish or big tunas or big giant groupers or king mackerel. You know, 3 or 4 months before you plan to be pregnant or during pregnancy. It's just not worth the risk.
Okay, I got you.
Yes. We're going in terms of just sustainability of these. I mean, it's getting harder and harder to, you don't even get caught anymore, do you?
No. But, you know, one thing I want to point out about the health issue is that also it's just as important. There's a risk-reward factor. For women who are pregnant, it is really important to get enough omega-3s. It's
yes.
really important to eat seafood 2 or 3 times a week if you're thinking about getting pregnant or pregnant, because those omega-3s are really important for good development for children, you
yeah,
know?
But, you know, they steer, because I saw what my daughter-in-law was given by her doctor. They steer uh-huh. them away from it.
Away from the fish?
Oh, yeah, away from fish, period.
Oh, no, that's not wise at all.
I know.
I mean, there's
been
many studies
do.
Which have been done which show that, you know, it's really important for children's good neurological and retinal and development. When
and actually, I think on the schedule for feeding the baby just turned a year, and I think it's still not allowed to have any fish.
Well, that's probably, you know, not a bad idea, because oftentimes kids will develop allergies if they're given particularly shellfish at too young of an
yeah,
age.
See, my theory is that if you don't let them eat this stuff, that's when they develop the allergies.
Yeah, that could be.
Where do you come down on the farmed versus wild issue, Paul?
Well, I'm a big proponent of wild fisheries and small boat fishermen, you know, the hook and line fisherman, the guy who's going out there and has, you know, fish locally for lots of years, you know. I don't feel that it depends, you know. With aquaculture, you can have good aquaculture, bad aquaculture. The good aquaculture is the type of aquaculture for clams, mussels, filter feed, scallops, the stuff like that. The bad aquaculture is the stuff any large carnivorous fish, such as the tuna, which is grown in open pens in the ocean. And the reason for that is, number one, these fish can escape and attack wild species. But most of all, you have to feed these fish. So what you have to do, if you have carnivorous fish in pens in the ocean, what you have to do is you will have to go capture small fish, such as anchovies, sardines, and squid, to feed these fish which you've captured. That takes food away from wild fisheries. And what it does... And,
okay, I see.
See? So, you know, I like wild fisheries because I feel like it's got better flavor. Because you know what they do when they take those sardines and anchovies, they dry them and mix them with soybeans and corn and, you know, turn it into pelletized food, which is somewhat like dog food.
Oh, yeah.
So it always has the same flavor, you know. There's no diversity of flavor. Whereas wild fisheries, you know, you get everything from the okay to the sublime.
Now we had a well-known chef. Seafood chef on the program the other day, the David Pasternak from Esca.
Oh yeah,
and we asked him about wild fish and versus farm fish, and he said I don't even want to talk about farm fish, but he also later on said it's really inevitable.
It's inevitable. That's where people are going to turn because we're losing all these species and volumes of species.
Well, aquaculture is not going to help help these species. That's for sure.
No.
But the thing is, it is inevitable. Because, you know, just like farming, the people who run aquaculture are large industrialized corporations. And they are eventually going to get that kind of stuff. You know, there's NOAA, the federal government right now is encouraging people to do aquaculture, you know. And it's just, I think it makes much more sense to take this natural system, to protect the natural system that we have in place, protect our rivers, protect our lands, protect the oceans, and we'll be able to grow all the fish that we could ever possibly want in a natural, good-tasting manner.
Without beating back all these the Japanese fleet.
Yeah, you have to keep the Japanese and the Russians out, I guess.
Well, you have the 200-mile limit, and you know we're always gaining more and more. International agreements to manage the high seas fisheries, the pelagic high seas fisheries.
This is an absolutely landmark achievement in the litany of fish.
Yeah, this is a keeper for our
this
library.
This is a keeper. Listeners, it's called Fish Forever. You can find it on the Menu Radio website at OTM Bookshelf. And you deserve to have a copy because it's so well organized. It's so incredibly obvious. Paul did absolutely the right thing. He said, why don't we just do the fish in alphabetical order?
Yeah.
what a great idea. So if you can get salmon or you can get skate or you can get croaker or you can get something else, all you need to do is know that there's going to be a section on that fish and you'll know how to fix it.
I mean, my complaint about is availability that fish stores, if you're not in a major area like, well, New York or Philadelphia or San Francisco, they only stock what most people want to buy, and so you don't get a big choice with unusual fish.
That's true.
Yeah.
Anyway, if you can, if you have this book in hand, you can be encouraged to know that there'll be instructions on how to prepare it. Paul Johnson, thank you so much for joining the program. It's been a delight to have you talk to us. We could talk with you for ages, but unfortunately we have to
take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. We're traveling. We are with Travel and Leisure. We have, hello, Peter. You're here still?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You
forgot I was here, and it's particularly important that I'm here because
you are our travel.
Well, the whole idea of requesting these books and figuring out how they might use them was something that I came up with because in the On the Menu family, Peter is sort of the lead travel planner. Thinker, guide, sort of out ahead of the places that we might want to go.
Otherwise called alpha male.
We have
Tanvi Chedda hanging on the line here, and I wanted to bring her into the conversation. She's an assistant editor of Travel and Leisure, and I'm assuming, Tanvi, that you've also worked on these two books that are just lovely.
Absolutely, Anne. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
I was hoping to share with you just, you know, some of the compelling stories and insider accounts that these books entail.
How about the titles? They're Travel and Leisure's Unexpected France and Travel and Leisure's Unexpected Italy.
Yeah, these are the magazine's first books that focus on single destinations. Of course, they compile a lot of these stories that have appeared in our magazine over the years and then combine them with user-friendly maps and, you know, editors' picks for the best places to eat, the best places to stay within those regions, and therefore, you know, provide readers with a great tool as well as the inspiration to make their own, you know, explorations possible.
Now, you made a great partnership here that was very helpful in putting these books together, because Travel and Leisure already had some wonderful stories, but then you had a special partner to help you actually put together more of the resources that are useful to people.
Exactly. Travel and Leisure partnered with DK Eyewitness Travel. They're, you know, the publishers of the full-color travel guidebooks. I'm sure you've seen many of them. They're
really
popular.
We use them all
popular.
The time.
Yeah,
yes.
I own about half the series, I think.
Oh, wow. Okay. So, exactly. I mean, these, our publishers in the DK publishers in London, along with us, came together to provide a great tool for our readers that, you know, basically preserve and extend our own material in a very timeless fashion, and also provide readers the tools to, you know, plan their own itineraries in the future, which is what I was sort of hinting at with those maps and, you know, the editor recommendations and really detailed guides to neighborhoods as well as where to eat and where to stay. So this was really the perfect time, especially, you know, as Europe becomes a difficult place to travel to given the dollar and things like that.
Oh, isn't that the truth?
So this is, you know, a really great time to sort of allow readers to plan their own journeys and itineraries in the most authentic fashion and, you know, without, sacrificing luxury or authenticity.
So you went about selecting stories about regions that were not necessarily that visited, like Provence.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Provence in France, I guess, qualifies as being fairly well visited, but some of the other places that you have, like the Aveyron, isn't very much visited, so you recommend that in Italy. You've got Pula in there as an unexpected destination. And when you take on Rome and Florence, you do things slightly differently than the regular tourists.
And they do out-of-the-way neighborhoods.
Right. So for example, you won't find how to get to the Vatican. You won't find how to get to the Vatican, but you will find out some other interesting things.
No, absolutely. I think, you know, the sort of underlying premise of these books is also to uncover treasures and sort of, you know, hidden delights and, you know, pristine treasures and sort of the corners of these regions that are not always, you know, explored, and therefore provide more of, you know, an authentic experience as well as, you know, tap into the richness and beauty of both of these countries.
Now, have you been to Puglia?
I have not been myself, but it's now, you know, topmost on my own travel plan.
Okay,
we were there before it was popular, and it was amazing.
Yeah, just because you read about it in the article, you decided it was a great place to go?
Exactly. I think also, you know, it's sort of Puglia's moment, as we talk about in the article. It's, you know, an unspoiled destination, you know, what was considered, you know, the Umbria of the 80s, possibly. You know, and the whitewashed towns there with the 15th century converted convents, you know, or the masserias, as they're known, these ancient fortified farmhouses, you know, in many cases are family run. They're, you know, a great place to stay at and have an authentic experience, and still a lot of, you know, affordability in that region.
And
we mentioned
there's somebody redoing up the caves. Where are those caves?
Well, that's in Basilicata.
It's
the town of Matera
in
Basilicata,
okay,
which is not far away.
Not far away.
A little bit further south.
Yeah.
it's actually just really to the left.
Yeah,
really just to the west.
A little bit western, exactly.
Just to put in a little bit of a plug for On the Menu, just so our listeners realize how far ahead we were. Guess what year we went to Puglia? We went there 8 years ago.
Oh my gosh! So you're ahead of the game. Absolutely.
Yeah, we went to Le Marche before you went there too.
So we should tap into you next time.
Well, you could if you were. No, this is just. Kidding aside here, it's really not luck. It's thinking ahead. But for those people who don't have time and who don't consult with
on
the menu radio all the time, these are absolutely a terrific starting point because they are the unconventional.
These books.
They are the kind of holiday where you won't meet your neighbors from down the street.
Exactly.
On the main street in Florence, which is the thing I suspect that many Americans who travel the traditional route to Florence go there because that's what Tuscany is all about. That's what they enjoy, and that's what they get, and they miss the other things.
Absolutely. I think, you know, as I was mentioning, these books really are about uncovering treasures, whether it's in Puglia, whether it's, you know, these neighborhoods in Rome, you know, Testaccio or, you know, Aquilino. These are neighborhoods where, you know, there's a mix of artists and butchers and immigrants and intellectuals, and, you know, you won't be meeting your neighbors from down the street, you know, as you overlook another, you know, Caravaggio painting. But you'll definitely see, you know, you won't sort of find trattorias that have won awards and, you know, for their ambiance and decor, but you will sort of eat the most, you know, special meals there, whether it's, you know, a puntarella salad or gnocchetti. You know, our writer who, you know, went to Rome to uncover these neighborhoods talks about how, you know, these, both of them have such a youthful energy.
The neighborhoods.
Yes, both these neighborhoods in Rome that we talk about in our Italy book, yeah. The Unexpected Italy book.
Do you have a pool of writers that you assign these stories to?
We do. I mean, we sort of tap into a global network of writers, correspondents, and, you know, photographers who are many times, you know, locals in those areas and therefore, you know, have a very authoritative voice on what's happening and also, you know, have a great pulse of, you know, can take a great pulse of what's happening in those cities or, you know, regions.
And how often do you travel?
I definitely not as much as I'd like to, but, you know, every few months I do try to travel myself, whether it's, you know, internationally or domestically. I think, you know, as sort of our editor-in-chief, Nancy Novograd, you know, talks about all the time, you know, travel is really just a way to great, you know, introspect onto yourself as well as, you know, see a region with new eyes, and I think it's, you know, definitely something that we stand for and believe in.
That's great. Now, these are just the first two books in what's intended to be a larger series?
Yes, absolutely. I think this partnership is so exciting and,
it is.
You know, really opens up the door for many possibilities down the road, you know, whether it's other regions of Europe or, I mean, you know, the entire world. So I think this is.
And don't forget to mention the absolutely smashing great photography, because that'll get people moving.
No, absolutely. I think, you know, these books can certainly be something that you keep on your coffee table just for the sheer beauty of them. But, you know, they're also so useful. And I think that's sort of what they're both really about, that, you know, they're meant to be an inspiration because of the photography, because of the vivid and, you know, compelling stories. But they're also such a guide and, you know, such a great tool to plan your own trip.
Now, what countries are coming next? Do you know? Are you not allowed to tell us?
Well, there's a lot of talk, so possibly, you know, more Europe, but it's really hard to say. I think it also depends on, you know, what our readers are interested in. You know, we really want them to feel like they can get as much out of these books and this partnership as possible.
Well, listeners, I think that these first two are a great start. The Unexpected Italy and Unexpected France, and you'll find them on our website, the OTM Bookshelf. So just go to www.onthemenuradio.com, click on OTM Bookshelf, and get these books and start your library.
Now, there's also a main site for Travel and Leisure magazine. Would you want to provide us with that too, so that listeners can just contact the magazine about all the other wonderful things you do?
No, absolutely. I think our website is a great place to start. You know, travelandleisure.com. It obviously is updated, you know, very frequently with all the latest information, you know, that we can provide to our readers from our own magazine, but as well as a lot of, you know, extras. And I think, as you were mentioning, these books are available at, you know, bookstores across the nation, including, you know, Barnes & Noble, you know, as well as Borders and Amazon.com.
Well, listeners, here's the piece of advice that we need to give you. You better get a copy of this book quickly. You better pick your places quickly so that a million of your neighbors aren't following right behind you. thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And now it's time to
take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Remember to email us anytime you get a random thought in your head that relates in some way to our program. And that's On the Menu at onthemenuradio.com. And Peter and I are chatting with our new best friend, Jordan Silbert, who has a fabulous product called Q-Tonic Water. And it's great. Jordan, welcome.
Thank you. Welcome to you, too.
Now, where did the idea for this begin? Go.
So, drunk in my backyard, like any good idea. A number of friends in my that I invited over, I was living in California and visiting my parents on 9/11. I'm from New York City, and as are a bunch of my friends. And
my goodness, you're not going to forget that, are you?
No, though I was trying, drinking a bunch of gin and tonics. So we hadn't seen it when we got back originally. We saw each other a lot, and then you get kind of caught up in your lives. And that next summer, we hadn't seen each other for a couple of months. And I said, you know, that's silly. We all moved back in large part, in some part, to spend time with our, you know, friends and family. I have this great backyard. Why doesn't everybody come over, you know, three Tuesdays from now? Like, clearly no one has any plans three Tuesdays from now. Good friend Justin emailed back immediately, saying, you know, fantastic idea. I just bought this bottle of Tanqueray. I'll set it aside. And so I responded, you know, I'll get some tonic water, see in a couple weeks. So then, you know, the night came, and on the way home, I picked up a couple bottles of tonic water at the local deli, and we started drinking, and I'm having a fantastic time. And maybe two drinks in, my teeth started feeling very sticky. And I picked up the bottle of tonic water and looked at it, and I was like, geez, there's 25 grams of high fructose corn syrup in this? That seems like a lot. I thought tonic water was just kind of like bitter water that kind of provided some balance to the gin.
Yeah, so did I until, actually, we have an anorexic friend who started buying diet tonic water. Until then, I didn't know that there was fructose in it.
That tastes even worse.
Oh, yeah, no, that's awful.
And we have to come back to the medicinal properties of quinine water too before we get off the phone, because you're doing something different with one of the other ingredients as well. But first of all, back to the sugar.
You want to get rid of the sugar.
So anyway, there was 25 grams of high fructose corn syrup. That seemed like a lot to me.
It's in everything.
One of my friend's girlfriends was drinking a can of Sprite, and I said, you know, hey, Sarah, can I look at your Sprite? And she said, sure. I looked at it, and it had 26 grams of high fructose corn syrup. Besides that, all the ingredients were the same. It was the same artificial flavors and artificial preservatives. The only real difference was that 1 gram of high fructose corn syrup, which is, you know, a 3% difference.
Oh, my goodness.
And the green bottle rather than the yellow bottle. So I said, guys, isn't that crazy? And I was like, yeah. And then, you know, like good friends do, we kind of got on another subject and another subject and another subject. And it's been, you know, another two, three, maybe four more gin and tonics in. The moon was shining down on this bottle of Tanqueray. And granted, I had had four or five gin and tonics. But the Tanqueray bottle, I don't know if you've looked at it recently, but it's not only really ornate, but somehow the green is just kind of resplendent. So there's this orb of green gin goodness, like glowing on the table. And I looked over and I saw the tonic water bottles that I had brought. And it was, first of all, plastic. It was the 1 liter plastic Schweppes bottles. That had been in the deli for a year and a half or however long it was. So it's quite crusty on top. The plastic was dented. It was going flat. And the yellow was like, the yellow label was peeling. And the color itself is something like out of 1958 or something.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, that's just crazy. Like, why isn't there a tonic water that's as good as the gin we're drinking it with, or the pals that I'm drinking, you know, I'm sharing it with? I think I should make a better tonic water. And he was like, great idea. And we had some more gin and tonics. And not even the next morning, the next afternoon when my head cleared, realized why tonic water was so lousy. you know, they replaced the real quinine with artificial quinine in the 1950s. And then they replaced the real cane sugar with high fructose corn syrup in the 1960s with all the sugar tariffs. And these tonic water companies really hadn't paid attention for you know, the last 40 years to the product. So I immediately ordered some bark on the internet from Peru, from the Cinchona tree, which is what quinine comes from, and ordered it and started making and trying to make it in my kitchen.
Now, what were you doing? You had a real job at this time.
I had a real job. I was the doing post-9/11 rebuilding stuff around the former World Trade Center site. I was the director of revitalization initiatives. So I came up with a lot of different ideas and then kind of get them funded and get them implemented that revitalized either the kind of residential or business communities in the area surrounding the former World Trade Center site.
Pretty intense, huh?
Yeah, it was an unbelievable job, and that was part of the reason I didn't want to quit and start a tonic water company immediately. I really was doing something that kind of meant a lot to me and felt like I was doing something pretty important.
But the gin and tonics helped too, I bet, right?
Yes.
Well, that's a remarkable story. So how do you go about becoming a tonic water maker?
Well, he has his bark and he's boiling it up in his kitchen.
That's exactly. My roommate was not so happy at the time, and he looked making fun of me for running. He's like, "We're going to get in trouble for running a meth lab. Like you got stuff." So I was boiling stuff and trying to extract this thing, and quite frankly, it was a disaster. It took me 3 years, and I would have people try this stuff, and it was like completely brown and nasty, and it's really awful tasting. Finally, one of my friends, like, "Great idea. You know, I really think you should do this, but like, you need to hire a food chemist." So I found a food chemist, and within like a day, she figured out how to extract the quinine. Because quinine is actually an alkaloid. That's the bitter taste you taste in tonic water. And it's actually has anti-malarial properties, and that's kind of
right.
How the gin
tonic.
That's
started.
Why the British started drinking
exactly.
It in India.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But you have to. It's a relatively simple chemical process, but I am an idiot. I couldn't figure it out. So anyway, this food chemist helped me figure that out. And once I had the quinine extracted, then I decided to use the agave. I tested all these sugars to balance out the sweetness, the carbonation.
So what year? This is about the time that agave became a very popular new sweetener.
It was winter of 2006-7. So
that's when it started showing up at the fancy food
show. And it's like once I tasted this agave, someone actually... I know one of the guys who started Honest Tea suggested that I try agave. Because I was kind of talking to everybody I could meet about, you know, how do I start a tonic water business? He said, "Why don't you try agave?" And I tried it, and I'd already tried cane sugar and molasses and all kind of about four or five different sweeteners. And once I tasted the agave first by itself, I was like, "Wow, this is the answer." And then I mixed it with the quinine, and it had that gentle roundness which complements the sharpness of the quinine. It was like, boom, this is the answer.
Yeah, I had somebody send me just pure agave syrup.
Yeah, phenomenal.
And I unfortunately gave it to my friend, the anorexic, and she wouldn't use it. So I got it back, and I took it to my trainer at the gym who loved it.
She should be using it. Totally coincidentally, like, we didn't design it this way, but agave has much fewer calories.
Oh, yeah, that's why I gave it to her.
Unit of sweetness.
Yeah.
So that's why our tonic water has so much less calories.
Yeah, but see, she prefers Splenda.
Now you did some other things here too, because this is not just a great product inside the bottle.
Yeah.
Presumably you've advanced from making it in your kitchen now.
Yes.
Now you don't make it in New York, do you?
No, we make it up in Massachusetts at a kind of a small filler that does a couple of all natural.
For some reason, I had the idea you were in some mid-Atlantic state. I think I told some people about that.
Well, Massachusetts is almost there.
Yeah.
I don't think so. even as geography challenged as I am, I know it's not in mid-Atlantic state.
But you did some more too, because the packaging is just absolutely.
Yeah.
Gorgeous.
Perfect.
Yeah, the idea is that the tonic water, when you drink a gin and tonic, it's only, or a vodka tonic, it's only 30% vodka or 30% gin. It's actually 70% tonic. And people are taking their vodkas and their gins very, very seriously. And the idea with this is going to be a tonic water that's as good, if not better, than the vodka or gin you're mixing it with. And so that's going to start with the ingredients. It's going to start with the follow with how we actually put it together, and then finish with how the thing actually looks. And so we have a bottle that I think is phenomenally beautiful.
It is. And it's designer designed.
Designer.
But you know,
Johann Leiden, he worked at he designed the Sean John perfume bottle. Did the worked for Mac Cosmetics. Like, he designs really wonderful perfume and other cosmetics packaging, and then a whole range of product.
Products. It's lovely, and the size is just perfect. For
yeah,
a
it's designed for
size.
One cocktail, because that's one of the things that drives.
Now there is a size like this, which is the size that you get tonic water and fruit juices, curiously enough, in pubs and bars in England. They come in that size because it's a one drink.
Single serve.
It's a single serve. So you picked up, I don't know whether you picked that up from the single serving concept of other places, or whether you just figured it out for yourself.
No, I figured it out myself, because obviously I think about tonic water more than the average person. But one of the things that drives me most nuts in the world is flat tonic water. And, you know, a 1 liter bottle, you never finish, especially if you're drinking with yourself or one other person at home. You never finish it all. Then you put it back in the refrigerator and it's never good the next day. So I wanted something that you just open and pour and have a phenomenal gin and tonic or phenomenal vodka.
I got really sad to see it go, because we had two bottles and Peter took more than his share. But I'm looking here and
it was going to go flat if I didn't drink it.
There is no way of resealing it.
Designed to not reseal.
And so, but I'm wondering, you're so busy. In fact, we had a hard time actually ecking out a time for this interview because you're so busy. So you're not encountering any market resistance to the fact that it's $10 for a 4-pack?
I don't think so. Obviously, we're not everywhere in the entire world, but right now it's like we've turned down probably 500 places this summer who wanted to sell this thing, and it was just... we weren't ready, kind of. We were working out our getting production capacity, and we're finally at a point where now we can say yes to everybody. But we said no to a lot of people at the beginning. So we haven't found any resistance yet. Who knows what's going to happen?
But you're selling it to upscale bars.
Yes, upscale bars, like literally Gramercy Tavern, Milk and Honey, Little Branch, the best bars in Blue Hill Stone Barns.
Oh, great.
You know, Moza out in L.A., Mario Batali's new place. So we're at like the very top bars and restaurants, as well as Whole Foods in New York City, the Dean DeLuca's nationwide.
That's
the very high-end, specialty good stores. And those people are already spending, you know, $8 on their jam. They're already spending, a lot of money on their fresh produce. And so the tonic water, a number of these places have almost thanked me. Instead of saying, oh, yeah, I'll buy the thing, they've actually thanked me. It's like, Jordan, thank God, now I can have a tonic water that's as good as all the other products that we sell. Like, tonic water is, we need to sell it because people want to buy it, but I've never had the option of providing something as good as the rest of the products that are in my store, in my bar, or in my restaurant. Now I can finally do that with tonic water.
Now you said you've been in touch with Scott Beattie, who's our old friend in California.
We love Scott.
We were talking about cocktails with him and talking about tonic water, and he told us exactly what you've told us earlier in the program. He said the reason that American tonic water doesn't taste any good is because it has the wrong sweetener in it.
Yep.
And he said, when you go to England, I said, well, you don't need to tell me about that because I used to be from there. He said the tonic water is different. The sweetener is different, and therefore it has the residual bitterness that is one of the little things that gin and tonic and vodka and tonic people love.
Yes, and it's not only the type. Obviously, they use cane sugar in England and high fructose corn syrup here, but it's also the amount. Like, there's as much high fructose corn syrup in a Schweppes tonic water in the U.S. as there is in 7-Up.
But you know this whole thing about why we have high fructose corn syrup and everything. Did you read The Omnivore's Dilemma?
Yes.
I mean, so the government's subsidizing all this stuff, and so you can't buy anything without this corn fructose.
And it's so bad for you, and it tastes so terrible.
And I always view it as petroleum.
Yeah. The other thing is, it's not just the government's fault. It's also these big companies' fault. They realize they can save, you know, to make my tonic water, it probably costs 10 times more per serving than maybe 8 times more per serving than Schweppes does. And, you know, Schweppes is owned by Cadbury Schweppes. Canada Dry, you know, these are large companies, and they make a decision. They'd rather save, a half a penny per serving than provide, you know, their customers with
a quality product.
So it's the government's fault. It's also these big companies' fault. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the great things about starting your own company is you get to make those trade-offs yourself. And I wanted to provide a great product.
I see it. A rosy future for you, by the way. I think the product is first rate. And better than that, even.
The story is absolutely fascinating. And you said you started out buying small lots of is it Kinchoya bark over the internet?
Yeah, and now, just, yeah, mix it up in my kitchen. Yeah.
Now you're presumably buying it on a somewhat larger scale, but it's still coming from Peru and it's still organic.
Yeah, it's coming from Peru. Actually, the quinine is not organic because it can't.
No,
be
it's
organic.
Hand-picked.
Oh, I see.
Okay. It's hand-picked.
So,
but the organic part is the agave.
So it's wild.
It's actually, they have a combination of wild and plantations down there.
Oh, okay, all right.
And we get both.
Okay.
But the reason it can't be organic, long story, is that it is extracted in a process that's not organic.
There's no such
thing as organic quinine.
Well, now, are you in the future, first of all, tell our listeners, can you order from the website?
You can order through our website. We have a couple of online vendors that distribute anywhere in the country.
How about tossing out a couple?
One is Sam's Wines out in Chicago, delivers everywhere. Mitchell's in New York delivers anywhere. Kegworks.com does everywhere as well.
Okay, great. And the second question is this going to be a one-product company?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, my idea is to do one thing and do it better than anybody else on the planet.
Ooh,
and we're
going
to focus,
amazing,
like, with laser-like precision just on tonic water and focus on just tonic water and do it better than anybody else. Well, at some point, we might have a different size bottle, but no, we're going to just do tonic water and do it better than everybody else.
Well, I love it, so...
But I should say the website is Qtonic. That's qtonic.com, and that's how you can do the you go to availability. You can click through and to the online vendors there.
Yeah, well, we're going to also put it on our website.
Oh, great! So you can go to your website.
Absolutely, perfect. And a truly fascinating story. What a great idea! You're going to conquer the world with tonic water all over again.
Or at least give people the options of drinking a better gin and tonic.
There you go.
That's great. Yeah, I can also use this. I'm doing a print article on cocktails, and this is part of that picture. That and also your buddy from Dry Soda, which is another wonderful product.
Fantastic, yeah.
Yeah, so I think Morton's is interested in that.
Well, Jordan, we wish you continued success, and please keep in touch if anything develops that you think our listeners should know. You know how to get in touch with us. We'll look forward to sharing in your success.
Fantastic. Thanks, guys. It's been great talking to you.
Yeah, thanks. Bye, Jordan.
Okay, bye.
Well, another day, another program, more interviews, more excitement, but I think that kind of wraps another program for us.
Does it?
Yes.
Okay, well, in that case, I guess we'll say, listeners, we'll look forward to seeing you.
Same time, next week.
Same place. You forgot the same place.
Bye-bye.